We continue our series in Mark, and we're in Mark 14. And were you here last Sunday evening with Mike Pavlou? Oh, he was great, wasn't he great? But I couldn't help noticing that Mike, in his inimitable way, went slightly off-piste. And he ended up, at least in part, preaching on the text that I'm meant to be preaching on, on Peter's denials in Mark 14. But it's such a great passage that it's worth looking again. Now, Mike spoke principally from Jesus' perspective. Do you remember that? Where he was talking about what it must have felt like for Jesus to be abandoned, rejected almost by his closest associates. Tonight I want to look at some of the same texts, the Mark 14, where Peter denies Jesus three times, but I want to look from Peter's perspective. So I'm going to ask Olivia to come and read the text for us. So why don't we listen to Olivia? Now, do you need a microphone? Okay, you're sorted.
Hello. So, if you need a church Bible, stick your hand up or grab one from the side. In the church Bibles, page 964, and we're going to be reading Mark chapter 14, verses 27 to 31, and then picking the story up again in verse 66 to 72. "You will all fall away," Jesus told them, "for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Peter declared, "Even if all fall away, I will not." "Truly I tell you," Jesus answered, "today, yes, tonight, before the cock crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times." But Peter insisted empathetically, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And all the others said the same. And then we'll pick up again in verse 66. Next page. Peter disowns Jesus. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with that Nazarene Jesus," she said. But he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said, and went out into the entrance. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around him, "This fellow is one of them." Again, he denied it. After a little while, those standing near said to Peter, "Surely you are one of them, for you are Galilean." He began to call down curses, and he swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." Immediately, the cock crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will disown me three times." And he broke down and wept.
Thanks, Olivia. It's fantastic. Well, many of us are very familiar with the Apostle Peter. He's one of the great characters of the New Testament. I want to just take a look at him in the context of these denials this evening. But before we plunge into that specific incident for him, let's just think about Peter generally. What I'd like you to do, if you won't mind, is just to get in groups of two or three. And if you're not familiar with Peter at all, well, just listen to the wisdom of the twos or three other people you're with. But if you know a little bit about some of the incidents of Peter, the walking on the water, and the way that he interacted with Jesus, perhaps you'd come up with a few of those things that you think are the main qualities of this man. And in turn, what are his main weaknesses? So his main qualities and his main weaknesses. Why don't you just talk to the person next to you, two or three people, what you think of Peter? Okay, Tom's coming around with a mic. Let's get a little bit of feedback here. What do we think of Peter? What are his good qualities? What are his weaknesses?
Yeah, we got a few. One was that he's extremely passionate, loyal, and impulsive, generally with a hot temper.
Right. Loyal and impulsive. So now, is impulsive a weakness? Yeah, it's a weakness, isn't it, I think? I'll put that on the weakness side. This is just for my notes, by the way. May refer to it later. Okay, any others? Any other thoughts?
God revealed to him that Jesus was the Messiah.
Sorry?
God revealed to him that Jesus was the Messiah.
Okay, so he had revelation.
I've heard him described as the caffeinated disciple.
The caffeinated disciple. Is that a weakness or a quality?
Yes.
Okay, any others?
Doubtful.
Doubtful, okay.
Definitely emotional in good ways and maybe not so good ways. And someone who tended to speak first and then think.
Okay. We got one over there.
He had the strongest faith out of all disciples, I think.
Sorry, strong?
He had the strongest faith out of all the disciples.
Strong faith, yeah.
And wholehearted. So just thinking of when Jesus washed his feet, and then Peter said, "Wash every bit of me."
Yeah. So he's a bit over the top, wasn't he? Any others? Okay, well, that's really enlightening. That's really enlightening. Peter, let's look at this passage. Verse 29, Peter declared, "Even if all fall away, I will not." And then Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times." But Peter insisted emphatically, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." Perhaps one of Peter's weaknesses is contradicting Jesus. You know, he does that a few times, doesn't he? Contradicting Jesus. It's never a good idea. If you're in the habit of doing that, stop it. Okay, so before the rooster crows twice, you will yourself disown me three times. A rooster is the American for a cockerel, if you didn't know that. Okay, it's a cockerel. Now, I grew up in a family with hens, and we had a cockerel. And the cockerel crows very early in the morning. The clocks went forward this morning, and I was doing 8 o'clock. I don't know. Colin, do you do the rota? Why was I doing it at 8 o'clock on the day that the clocks go forward? So I got up at 6:30, which of course is 5:30, isn't it? And it was still a bit dark. And if we still had a cockerel, the cockerel would have already crowed. Because they crow when it's still... You think it's still pitch black. So we had this cockerel, and it used to make a terrible din and wake everybody up. So we thought, we'll sort this. We blacked out the hen house completely blacked out. It was like a photographic darkroom. But cockerels have an internal clock. And they know when they can cry out and still be irritating. And, you know, we had a neighbour come round to wish us a happy Christmas one year. And she made conversation. She said, "Oh, what are you having for Christmas lunch? A cockerel?" And you could hear the pleading in her voice. So, as she in this passage, as we'll see later, it may not be a literal cockerel, but we'll come back to that. Peter was never someone to hold back, was he? As Chris said, he spoke first and then he thought second. He tended to act first and then assess the situation second. And as such, even though we might say that's a weakness, as such, I believe that Peter was a man after God's own heart, because his heart ruled his head, not the other way around. He acted on impulse. He is the David of the New Testament, because David, the great king in the Old Testament, was like that as well. He was passionate. He was impulsive, I think Tim used the word. He was flawed, but ultimately he was a very inspirational leader on whom Jesus wanted to build the church. Peter was a man of immense courage. I mean, he walked on the water. Okay, we all remember that he sank. But nobody else did they? They all were happy in the boat. He was the only one. He got out of the... He had a go. Immense courage. On the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter offered to build tabernacles for Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. Completely nuts. Even when the mob came and arrested Jesus, Peter drew his sword and started to attack them. So this was one fisherman versus a whole troop of trained soldiers. I mean, that was only going to end badly, wasn't it? This chap was crazily courageous. He was prepared to take on a troop of soldiers single-handed without any military training. He was reckless in his courage. He took no account of his own safety, no account of his own dignity. He would launch out when the chances of success were zero. Peter, of whom Jesus said, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." He's a rock, you see, he's a rock. Incredibly solid, incredibly strong, and incredibly tough, incredibly reliable. And Jesus said, "You're like just that solid rock. I'm going to build the church on you." And Peter, it says, he says, "Even if everyone falls away, I won't. I won't." Now, the word "fall away" is the word "scandalizin." And it means, you know, scandal means something, outrageous behavior that's sort of the subject of salacious gossip, isn't it? But scandalism is slightly different. It means to trap. It means, the root of the word is to limp or to stumble or to be trapped. You know, I was really saddened in the last week or so to read about Jack Straw and Malcolm Rifkin. I don't know whether you saw the news. For my generation, Jack Straw and Malcolm Rifkin were very significant politicians. One of them Labour, the other Conservative. One of them had been Home Secretary, and the other had been Foreign Secretary. They had very long and distinguished careers in high office, in the corridors of power. They were highly respected. And they fell for a tabloid sting where they were secretly filmed offering their services and their influence for money. They were trapped. Scandalizen. They were trapped. And how could such distinguished men, now quite elderly in the last years of their lives, after having had such esteemed careers, how could they fall for something like that? Well, I guess they had just grown proud. They thought that they were kind of untouchable. They thought they could get away with anything. It reminds me of when Jesus, speaking to the Laodiceans in Revelation 3, says, "You do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked." You don't realize it. You think you're untouchable. You think you're so great. You think you can get away with anything. You can't. "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you," says Peter. You see, he's falling into the same trap. He thought that he was stronger than he actually was. He's become a little bit proud, thinks he can get away with anything. In the English Civil War, the Roundheads, the anti-monarchists, captured the Marquess of Huntly. It was a Scottish lord. He was called the Cock of the North. And they captured him and they pointed to the block and were sort of sharpening the axe. And they told him that unless he renounced his loyalty to the monarch, Charles the First, unless he renounced that loyalty to the monarch, they would execute him then and there. And this is what he said: "You can take my head from my shoulders, but you will never take my heart from my king." And they duly executed him. But it's I think it's a wonderful. Yeah, he paid for it with his life. It's a great quote, isn't it? "You can take my head from my shoulders, but you will never take my heart from my king." That's what Peter is saying. It's the same, isn't it? "I'm prepared to die rather than disown you," says Peter. Well, let's move on to the second portion of the text. You remember that Olivia jumped from verse 31 to verse 36 because we go through the accounts of the Garden of Gethsemane and then the arrest of Jesus. And then they call together the Sanhedrin for an illegal sitting of the Sanhedrin, which acted not just as a governmental oversight body, but also as a court of law. And if you want to hear more about that, listen to Colin's sermon this morning. because they were now meeting in a illegal session in the high priest's personal residence. They've arrested Jesus and they've brought him to the high priest's house and gathered there, and Peter has been following at a distance. And we come to verse 66. So we know exactly where this happened. It happens in the high priest's house that has been excavated. We know exactly the spot. We know it because the high priest's house was quite a big complex, quite a big palace, really, and it had a disproportionate number of storerooms attached to it for receiving the tithes that were due to the high priest. And so we know where it is. And you can go there. And I went there in the autumn. And here is a picture of the road. You can see in the across the bottom of the picture is a stone-paved road, which is coming up from the Kidron Valley, which is where the Garden of Gethsemane was sited, up to the Mount Zion, which was a residential area. And you can see the Dome of the Rock in the back, which is where the Temple Mount was, not far away. And this road is still there. Those paving slabs are the very paving slabs that Jesus, followed by Peter, would have walked up that day. And I visited there end of October last year. The high priest's house. And Mike actually mentioned this last week, because underneath the high priest's house is a single cell where Jesus would have been held when he wasn't actually in front of the court of the Sanhedrin that night. Do you remember Mike told of how he went down into that cell experienced great emotion? He wept. And one of the many things that I have in common with Mike is 10 years previous to that, I had the exact same experience. If I went down into that cell, and I found it a very emotional experience. We go on to the next slide. They've built a church over it now, which they tend to do, but the cell is still there intact underneath. And you go to the next slide, and there is the cell, and the person in the middle there is Elise. Do you remember Elise? And she was on the same tour as us last autumn around Israel, as Jane and I went, and we just found that Elise was on the same tour. And there she is, down in this cell, underground, where Jesus would have been held. But the main action of this passage doesn't actually happen inside the high priest's house or in that cell. It happens in the courtyard outside. And the courtyard's no longer there, sadly, but they've kind of built a little courtyard, and they've got a rather nice statue of Peter in the middle of that courtyard with the people addressing him. And on top of a column next to him, you can see the cockerel. And so that's exactly where this took place. We know exactly where it took place, in that courtyard. Now let's look at the incident in the high priest's courtyard. What was Peter doing there? Well, Peter was fulfilling his promise. Before we're too down on him for denying Jesus, he was fulfilling his promise, or so he thought. He said, "Even if I have to die with you, Jesus, I will never disown you." And so there he is. All the rest of the disciples have abandoned Jesus. Where are they? They've gone. They're off. But Peter's there still, isn't he? He's there. He's followed Jesus. He's not disowning Jesus. He wants to be there next to them. So crazy, reckless Peter. Hugely courageous. No account for his own safety. Walks into the courtyard of the high priest, where his Lord is being tried with the death penalty hanging over him. Peter walks in. The others weren't there. He's being true to his word. And then it all starts to go wrong, doesn't it? Because first a servant girl comes to Peter. And she identifies him as one of the disciples. How does she do that? Well, Peter is a Galilean fisherman. So he's from up north. He's got the equivalent of a Geordie accent. He's got big, burly hands and rough skin. He is not like the smooth, suave intelligentsia of the Jerusalem set. He's completely out of place. He's really easy to identify. So you're one of them, are you? And he denies it. He denies it. But he still doesn't move. A weaker man would have skulked off into the night, wouldn't he? But Peter, no, he stands his ground. Even while he's denying Jesus, he's still wanting to be there and not deny him. Wanting to be close to Jesus. Second time, the servant girl comes back to him. You must be one of them. You're a Galilean, for heaven's sake. And he denies it again. But still he doesn't leave. He's still there. He's both incredibly courageous and hopelessly weak at the same time. And the third time somebody comes to him, this time it's a bystander. The word's getting out. And then he completely crumples. And he starts cursing and swearing and calling down curses on himself, saying, I don't know the guy, it's nothing to do with me. And then the cock crows and he is completely undone and he flings his cloak around his head and weeps. Just a little earlier in the chapter, in the Garden of Gethsemane, three times Jesus, in unbelievable duress, Jesus puts his whole life in the hands of his heavenly Father. And now, in a sort of hideous mirror of that, Peter, three times, Jesus' right-hand man, three times, denies he even knows Jesus, doesn't want anything to do with Jesus. Now, I said earlier that it's probably not a literal cockerel. In Roman Jerusalem, the night ran from 6 o'clock in the evening to 6 o'clock in the morning. And it was divided into four watches of the night. And at the beginning of each new watch, there would be the changing of the guard. As the soldiers who had been watching the first watch went off duty and a new lot came onto duty. And so at the Roman garrison, you had this changing of the guard, and that changing of the guard was heralded by a bugle call. And the bugle call was called the Gallicinium. The Gallicinium, which is Latin for the cock crow. And so the second Gallicinium, the second cock crow, would have been exactly at midnight. It's like it's a watershed moment. Right in the middle of the night. Right in the middle of that night, it marks the moment of the total and final abandonment of Jesus of everyone. The last man standing, Peter, finally completely flunks it at midnight. Now Jesus is utterly alone, without help, without companionship. No one can come to his aid. He and he alone sets out to save the world, as it had to be. No one else plays any part in Jesus' dramatic act of salvation that he was going to fulfill. He's on his own. But back to Peter's perspective. This is Peter's moment of terrible, terrible failure. You know, Peter, he had great qualities. We listed some of them, didn't we? He was passionate. He was loyal. He heard God's voice. He was sensitive to revelation. He was a man of incredible faith. He was wholehearted. This is from your list. I would add to it that he was an incredible leader. He was a very honest man, very bold, very courageous. And then some of his weaknesses. Spoke first, thought second. He was probably overconfident sometimes. He was a bit hypo, he was a bit caffeinated, self-reliant. And as a result, sometimes really lacked understanding. I suspect that he had a bit of a short fuse. He kind of swung both ways. Sometimes he was full of faith. Sometimes, you know, he was very muddled, changeable. How do we know about this incident in the high priest's courtyard? It appears in all four Gospels, and Peter is on his own. In John's Gospel, there is mention of an unnamed other disciple who went with him at first, but for all intents and purposes, Peter was on his own. So how do we know of this incident? Surely it can only be that Peter himself related this incident, probably to Mark. We think that Mark that one of Mark's main sources was Peter himself. Mark was partially, at least, acting as a scribe for Peter, or that's what is thought. And so here's Peter, showing incredible humility, actually, as the leader of the worldwide church, telling Mark, you write this down. This is the backstory. This is what really happened. And it doesn't put him in a great light. Peter is a bit of an enigma because he is both utterly reliable, so much so that Jesus entrusts the leadership of the church to him and calls him a rock. Utterly reliable. And at the same time, hopelessly unreliable. Says he'll do one thing and does the opposite. Proclaims Jesus as the Son of God one moment and then rebukes Jesus the other. Peter. Now, I strongly identify with Peter. I have few of his better qualities, but I too have had to respond to the call of God to be a leader in the church. That Jesus would build his church on me. And yet, what I feel most of the time is overwhelming weakness. Called to be a rock when I feel like a lump of jelly. how I long for Peter's courage, his fortitude. There's not a day that goes by when I don't ask God for more courage. Now, how would I respond in the high priest's courtyard? Would I even be there? Probably not. What about you? What about you? Not all of you are called to church leadership as I am, but you are all called. God wants to do something in your life and through your life. God wants to build something on you. What is the area of your life that God is calling you to be a rock? Where is it that you identify with Peter? You know, we've had Je suis Charlie, where people wanted to so identify with the terrible things that happened at the Charlie Hebdo thing in Paris. Well, this evening we have Je suis Peter. We are all Peter. We all identify with Peter. We all have that place where Jesus comes to us and saying, you're the rock that I want to build on in this particular area. That's our calling. So how would you respond in the high priest's courtyard when you're really put on the block, when they're sharpening the axe and point to the block? Are you going to say, you can remove my head from my shoulders, but you will never take my heart from my king? Peter was being tested. A trap, in effect, was laid down for him, and he fell into it, and he spectacularly failed the test. And his biggest failure was he thought he was strong. I'll never deny you. Even if I have to die, he thought I was strong. Paul, of course, famously says in 2 Corinthians 12, verse 10, for when I am weak, then I am strong. If only Peter had heard those words, that might have changed his perspective. So where are you being tested? Where is your faith being stretched? Where are you really up against it? And you've got to come out on the Lord's side. Where do you look at life and think, I can't do it, I'm so weak? That's actually a better place to be than the Peter place where he says, oh yes, I'm strong. Shall we pray? Why don't we stand up? And Alice, do you want to come up?